You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, as more and more dangerous goods traverse Canadian rail lines, communities across northern BC are worried about emergency preparedness if a derailment occurs close to home. Rail safety in this part of the country has been a long-standing issue, especially since the Lac Mégantic disaster in Quebec more than a decade ago. With the prospect of more dangerous goods like diesel, propane, and other hazardous materials traveling through Northwest BC, Member of Parliament for Skeena-Bulkley Valley Taylor Bacharach pressed Transport Canada officials this week about emergency preparedness plans and risk assessment reports, which Transport Canada has kept confidential. The questioning has launched 6 days of parliamentary hearings on whether communities are adequately protected from spills and fires caused by rail transport of dangerous goods. On Friday, the federal transport minister announced more than $45 million in improved rail safety across the country. Today, we speak with MP Taylor Bacharach about why he brought this to the committee's attention again and how lawmakers can improve rail safety across Canada that better protects communities. Stay with us.
Taylor Bacharach, I'm the Member of Parliament for Skeena-Bulkley Valley and the NDP's critic for transport and rural economic development. And I'm here in Ottawa this evening.
Great, Taylor. Thanks so much for being with us on CICK News again. Of course, we've talked about this before. You've brought this up in committee before, and this is a long-standing issue across northern BC especially, but here in the Northwest, we've seen an increase in hazardous materials being transported on the train. Tell me a little bit about what you brought up at the Transport Committee this past week.
For sure. So I've initiated hearings at the Transport Committee on the topic of community emergency response to incidents involving dangerous goods shipped by rail. And this is it's an issue that's on a lot of folks' minds in the Northwest because we've seen the dramatic increase in the transport of dangerous goods through our community. A lot of it is associated with new marine terminals on the coast, and that's brought with it, you know, jobs and economic benefits. At the same time, it raises these questions that folks have been asking for a long time about what is the capacity of our communities to respond if something goes wrong on the rail line. And the committee has done work before on rail safety, and a big part of the conversation has been about how do we reduce the likelihood that something happens? That's super important, right? Talking about how do companies operate the rail more safely? How does the government regulate them and require them to, uphold the best safety standards so that the chance of something bad happening is extremely small? That's the ideal. But at the same time, communities have to be prepared for the eventuality that something could go wrong. And we've seen this happen across Canada and around the world. The most high-profile incident happened about 10 years ago in Quebec, in a place called Lac Mégantic, where an oil train that was poorly secured rolled down a hill into the downtown of the community and burst into flames, caught fire, and destroyed a significant portion of the downtown. 47 people died. Now, in the wake of these kinds of disasters, and these have happened all over the world, the government often flies into action and they put all sorts of measures in place and they try to strengthen regulations. And, you know, the Auditor General looks into what happened and how could this happen and all of these things. My question is, how do we look down the road and say, you know, we don't want something like that to ever happen in one of our communities? In Fraser Lake or Houston or Burns Lake or Telqua, Smithers, you know, on down the line. And so how do we look at the risk, look at the capacity of our first responders and make decisions and invest resources so that should something go terribly wrong, the people who are charged with protecting the lives of our neighbors have what they need to respond effectively. I think that's a pretty reasonable expectation. And that's what my questions have really been directed towards.
Taylor, one of the things you pointed out, as you mentioned, what is the plan? What are the emergency plans? But also it sounds like there's some confidentiality that Transport Canada was citing why they haven't released some of these plans or what communities can do if this does happen. What do you have to say about that, of them, Transport Canada, keeping some of this information confidential?
Well, I think this really speaks to the need for transparency, because the public has questions, first responders have questions, and yet the assessments and the emergency plans that the government requires, many of them are considered proprietary. So they're not available to you and me or to anyone living in our communities to see what the actual risks are and to see what the plan is if something goes wrong. And so, you know, at the end of the committee meeting, I brought forward a motion to force the companies and the government to produce those plans. One of the powers that parliamentary committees have is the power to order documents. And, you know, that's a pretty far-reaching power. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to gain access to those plans and really have a clearer line of sight on what exactly the capacity of communities is and what the risks are that we should be focused on. But the question was, I was trying to focus my questions for Transport Canada on this question of what a sufficient response capacity looks like in their minds. It seems to me, from what I've learned, that every community is on their own. The training is voluntary, and we have communities with vastly different capacities. We have fire departments in the Northwest that are very professional, that have sophisticated equipment and lots of training. And we have other departments that rely on volunteers, that have limited budgets, that have limited equipment, and as a result, a limited capacity to respond to big events. And when we're talking about fires or spills involving potentially multiple tank cars full of dangerous goods, these can be really big events. And so this is where the question is, how do our smaller communities respond effectively? And how do we protect human life and make sure that if something goes really wrong, everyone is kept safe? So those are the questions I was asking. It was shocking. If you've watched the video, it was pretty shocking. Like we're talking about the Director General for the Transport of Dangerous Goods in Canada, from Transport Canada, and the Director of Rail Safety. And the answers that they gave, like for many of the questions, they just simply didn't have the information. They didn't have answers.
Let's take a listen to some of those clips from the Transport Committee.
I did share with you prior to the meeting a page from the Emergency Response Guidebook to which Transport Canada contributes.
Yes.
And this table on page 359 talks about blevies, boiling liquid evaporating vapor explosions. I'm sure as the Director General for Transportation of Dangerous Goods, you're familiar with these events.
Yes.
Extremely high consequence events with massive destructive force. I'm just wondering if you could, based on the table, the way I read it, the minimum time, if you could share with the committee, the minimum time to blevie failure for a tank car experiencing full torch conditions. So this would be a tank car with 140,000 liters of dangerous goods, such as propane, on board.
Yeah, I'll have to take that back to my experts.
No, but it's in the table that the experts created. It's 9 minutes.
Okay.
So from full torch condition,
yep.
9 minutes until this tank car turns into a bomb. Mm-hmm. Now, if you could, according to the table, what is the minimum evacuation radius for a potential blevie involving a car carrying 140,000 liters of propane?
The minimum evacuation distance is 1,715 meters, according to this.
So 1.7 kilometers. So am I reading it correctly that you would have to evacuate a 1.7 kilometer radius to avoid a blevie, which can occur within 9 minutes of a car reaching full torch condition?
Mm-hmm. That's what the
9 minutes. That's what the table says, yeah.
Yeah.
How quickly after a derailment could a full torch condition occur?
I couldn't answer that.
Like it can occur very quickly after a derailment.
Yeah.
Is the capacity of communities to evacuate rapidly in such a situation evaluated as a part of approving emergency response assistance plans?
In an emergency response assistance plan, you are looking at the equipment that is available, the technical advice,
no,
the technical
specifically doctors. Evacuations plans.
I'll have to consult with my experts on that one.
Okay, if you could get back to the committee, it would be appreciated.
Yes. There's an aspect of this where the people who are in charge just don't want to talk about it. Probably because the answer is that we're not actually that prepared for some of these worst case scenarios. If we're talking about something called a bleve, which is a boiling liquid evaporating vapor explosion, this is essentially where a pressurized tank car full of dangerous goods heats up because it has fire applied to the outside of it. And the pressure inside builds up to the point where the tank ruptures. And the rapid change in pressure essentially creates this giant fireball, can have incredibly destructive force. And looking at the table that's provided in the emergency response guidebook, which first responders use for responding to dangerous goods incidents, there's a table that talks about bleve and the evacuation distance that's required for a rail car with 140,000 liters of dangerous goods on board. The evacuation distance is 1.7 kilometers. The minimum time for a tank car to bleve, if it's exposed to what's called full torch condition, so if there's something burning next to it and heating it up rapidly, it can explode in as little as 9 minutes. So, you know, we're talking about really dramatic scenarios, and these are low probability events, like, to be clear. But if something like this happens, there is very little time, and there are a lot of people in our communities that would be at risk. If you draw a 1.7 kilometer circle around the rail yard in any of our communities along Highway 16, the chances are you'll take in the fire hall, the hospital, you know, a lot of the services that are required, as well as hundreds of people who live and work in proximity to the train tracks. And so those are some of the tough questions that I'm trying to get to the bottom of. And frankly, it doesn't seem like the government has thought through what the plan would be in these cases. And, you know, we have incredible first responders in our communities. We have amazing fire departments. Many of the firefighters are volunteers who take time out of their personal lives to protect their neighbors, which is just, you know, it's one of the most admirable and honorable things you can do. And they have limited capacity. They have limited equipment. They have limited budgets. And, you know, originally they were tooled up to deal with house fires, to deal with structural fires. Many of them now take on rescue responsibilities as well, and they have training and capacity for rescue. But when you're talking about these large-scale industrial fire events involving dangerous goods, a lot of them don't have the kind of capacity that would be required to effectively deal with a situation in a timely way. And so that's the gap that we're trying to shed light on and hold the government accountable. You know, the federal government regulates the railroad. This lands on the minister's lap ultimately, and they should be held accountable.
I will point out, Taylor, you know, this is not just a particular issue to our neck of the woods. This is an issue right across the country. I see here that yesterday, the Transport Minister, Anita Anand, announced $45 million to improve rail safety, specifically at two points near London, Ontario, that are problematic. But obviously, they're shining light on this issue of rail safety and keeping communities safe and pouring millions of dollars into this. But it seems that it's falling short, as you mentioned, because a lot of these plans, a lot of this capacity is not rolling out fast enough to places like Smithers and Terrace, Prince Rupert, anywhere along the line. There was a little bit of a derailment a couple of years ago near Prince George, where a school was evacuated. Now, that was more of a fire rather than an explosion, but it had the potential to get to, you know, a critical level. school still had to be evacuated. So where do you see this going in terms of actually getting some boots on the ground to improve some of this safety and make sure that these communities and these fire chiefs, especially these fire departments, have the equipment, the resources that they need? Who are you bringing in to maybe shine some light on this as well?
Yeah, the folks who really know this topic area well are the first responders. And so at our hearing, we're going to hear from the Canadian Association of Fire Chiefs. It's an organization that represents all of the fire chiefs across Canada, from the smallest departments right up to the big professional urban fire departments. And I think they're going to have some very interesting information to share with the committee when it comes to what's required to successfully battle a large-scale event involving dangerous goods and the kind of preparedness that communities need to look at. You know, communities of all sizes are dealing with this question. You know, the rail lines go through big cities in Canada too, and with increasing population density and more development near the rail line, there's more and more people living and working in close proximity to those dangerous goods. And so this is it's a question that a lot of people are grappling with. And I do think there's a gap there. And that gap is especially pronounced in small communities because they have so little capacity to respond. You know, the other aspect that I was talking with one first responder about was water capacity. Because if you have a tank car that's on fire, one of the techniques for preventing it from exploding is to spray water on it to cool it down. Well, you need to spray a lot of water on it for a long time. And in smaller communities, the municipal water supply or the village water supply isn't actually sufficient to pour water on a car for that long. So these are all questions that I think deserve answers. And my concern is that Transport Canada, which is the regulator, this is the government entity that is responsible for regulating the shipper, the railway, they don't really seem to be taking it as seriously as they should be. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. It might be a bit of an understatement, but you know, I think more and more communities are going to have these questions. There's some really interesting work happening in the Terrace area with Kitsum Kalem and Kitsilis. They've teamed up on a community capacity, like emergency response capacity research project, and they're studying, you know, what the capacity of the community is. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the results from that and what their findings are. But up and down the line, this is something fire chiefs and local governments have been talking about for years and years. I've been working on it for at least a decade, ever since I was mayor. And there's a real latent frustration out there because it's so difficult to get answers, from the government, to get answers from the rail companies. And we have these dedicated fire chiefs and first responders who want to do what's necessary, and they want to have the support. They want people to have their backs, and they deserve the information, and they're not always getting it. So this is the challenge. We're going to keep leaning into it, and hopefully these hearings can make a meaningful contribution to that work. At the end of the hearings, the committee will write a report, which will describe the testimony that we heard, and then we'll have a chance to vote on recommendations. So this is essentially what members of parliament on the committee feel the government should do about it. And that report with the recommendations will be tabled in parliament. It'll go to the government, and the government has to respond formally to the report and table its response in parliament as well. So it's one tool we have for accountability, and we're going to make the most of it.
Okay. Taylor, we'll leave it there for now, but thanks so much for your insight on this, and please keep us updated as these hearings continue on.
Hey, I appreciate your interest, Dan. I know this is something that a lot of folks are concerned about, and you know, hopefully people listen to your coverage and tune into the hearings.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at cicknews@smithersradio.com or check us out on the web at smithersradio.com. CICK News has been made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to my colleague Pam Hassan and all of our roving journalists, I'm Daniel Messick. Thanks for listening.
Learn more about CICK, visit us at smithersradio.com. Yeah, .com.